And we'll start as a with some information. First part informational item, Steve, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your agenda today, we have a short information item that we'd like you to consider, and that is a request by the co-chairs and the Public Safety Regulation Subcommittee regarding agency legal costs.
Headed by Senator Miller.
Yes. If you look right under the today's agenda in your pile of materials, you'll see a letter from the co-chairs and from the Public Safety and Regulation Subcommittee regarding agency attorney general costs and efforts to reduce the demand for those AG services and essentially to control the costs to agencies of AG resources. What this letter requests this subcommittee to do is essentially, if you look at the first paragraph before the bullet items on the last sentence, you can see that the co-chairs in the subcommittee are requesting that you direct all agencies that come before you to do a number of things. And what these things are listed in these bullet items. They include formally adopting a what is known as a gatekeeper policy, which is essentially, this has been distributed to the agencies, and what the gatekeeper policy is it's a policy for them to designate specific staff in their agency that would, who would have actions with the Attorney General in terms of requesting services. Some other recommendations or requests are that you direct agencies to establish realistic time goals for the use of legal services. The problem is when agencies wait too long to request the legal services and things are on a rush basis, then very often the Attorney General needs to contract with outside counsel to get things done in time, and this increases the cost. And this increases the cost to everyone involved. There are a number of other items here. Some of them involve collaborating with the Department of Justice to create standardized forms for contracts and procurement. The recommendations include working with the Department of Justice on obtaining class exemptions from legal sufficiency reviews. So in other words, if an agency is entering into a number of contracts and this is a recommendation that that agency work with the Department of Justice to see if there are, it's possible for there to be exceptions for the Attorney General having to review the legal sufficiency of all these contracts under specific and agreed circumstances. And finally, developing or working with lay representatives. This would involve situations where agencies have contested case hearings or administrative appeals, and they would essentially work with DOJ to identify people in the agency who could represent the agency at these hearings in cases where an actual attorney is not necessary. The purpose of this discussion here is, first of all, to relay this information to you, and secondly, I would request advice to us, your staff, as to how you would want to implement this, assuming that you do. What I see is basically, I can think of three alternatives, though there are probably more, but the first alternative is if for whatever reason you do not agree with these recommendations, we would relay this information back to the co-chairs and the Public Safety Subcommittee, whose chair is sitting right here, so he would be hearing if that's a problem. But assuming that you don't have any problems with this and you wish to fulfill the request, I would think the two alternatives would be following. You could either direct us as your staff to relay to all of the agencies that will be coming forward from this point on that they are to respond in their budget presentations to these specific requests and add that as a part of their standard budget presentation to you. A second alternative that I could see is that essentially you direct us, your staff, to provide this information to all of the remaining agencies that will be coming forward to this subcommittee, and to instruct those agencies that it is the subcommittee's intent that the agency follow these guidelines, and that put the onus, therefore, on the agency that if they have any concerns about this, that they are expected to bring them up during their presentation. But if they do not do that, we will have informed the agency that this is your expectation, even though it wouldn't be specifically discussed for each budget. And then when we put together the budget report, we would include some kind of boilerplate language in each budget report, because you do have to do it for each agency. There's not an overall method for doing this, saying that essentially the subcommittee directed the agency to perform the activities in the memo of February 13th, and we'll think of the proper language to convey that.
Yeah, if there's no objections from the committee, I would like to have us follow the second suggestion of Steve, and that is to notify all of the agencies that are going to appear before us that we would like them to follow the suggested strategies to control, reduce agency legal costs, and if for some reason they say they can't or they won't, why then I hope LFO will work something out with them before they come before our committee, and we have to waste time doing that.
Oh, okay.
Senator Miller, would you suggest that, or do you have a better idea how to get agencies to understand what we're trying to do?
Senator Hartung, you may want to confer with counsel before you answer this question.
As long as they don't charge me for it.
I think you're correct, and I don't think we're looking to necessarily go through this with everybody that comes before us. It is mostly advisory, suggestive. The first part, I think, is important to me. The really important piece is the gatekeeper function. And that is, Senator Troll and I worked on the Department of Justice budget, and we were able to reduce the rates from the requested 106 down to 97 per hour. The fundamental fact is that it could be $150 per hour, and if you don't ask for the service, it won't cost you anything. So what we're trying to do is reduce the number of hours requested as well as the rate when requested. So I think, as you've suggested, Mr. Chairman, that'd be the right route.
Senator Troll, do you have a comment?
Yes. I've looked at this, and it looks okay. I would sort of like to have some more time maybe to review it with our caucus, but it looks okay, and it seems to me like that we do want to cut these costs, and these are good suggestions. I don't know exactly... it was the first time I've seen this document, so I haven't had a chance to absorb it. It's consistent, I think, with what we did in the subcommittee, but I'd like have a chance to review it. But you can go ahead and approve it as far as that, and I won't object at all, but I just, with the reservation that I'd like to think about it, I do think this, and that is that although we want agencies to be careful about their attorney general costs and to minimize those costs when it's cost effective to do that, but also to use the attorney general when it saves you money, to use the attorney general to keep you out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't want is some kind of barrier that keeps us from doing that.
Good point. Right. Other comments? Yes, Senator Hobbs, or Representative Hobbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the back of my mind is the desk gatekeeper policy. Steve, could you give us a little help on what was the context in which that was distributed? I kind of remember reading something, but I'm not sure where it is, and I'd like to go back and take a look at it.
Good question.
Unfortunately, Representative Hopson, I asked today to see if our office had a copy of the gatekeeper policy, and we do not have, we were not actually given a copy when the other agencies apparently were. So I can't even, I guess I can't answer your question at this point as to exactly what the wording of the policy is and how it was distributed to agencies.
Can you get that for us?
We are trying to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Chair, maybe we could have DAS come and talk to us about their policy and how it fits with this policy.
Yeah. Well, that'd be good. I'd like to see the printed word first, and then maybe we could have Das come.
Okay.
That'd be okay?
We'll get that.
Okay. Any other questions? And without objection, why we will adopt the suggested strategies to control, reduce agency legal costs. Okay, thank you, Steve. And now we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5521, the Health Licensing Office, and also the public hearing on Senate Bill 5523, the Health Licensing Office e-bill. Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I distributed to your offices this morning a copy of a memo describing this agency. I have some extras.
Thank you.
You bet. The Health Licensing Office was officially created last legislative session. Prior to that, the Health Licensing Office resided within the Health Division. The Health Licensing Office oversees the 9 regulatory boards, councils, or programs. Those 9 are listed on the second page of that handout that I just provided to you. The governor's recommended budget is a 29.9% increase over the 9901 estimated expenditures and a 20.5% increase over current service level. As with other health-related boards, this Health Licensing Office is funded 100% from other funds, from license and application fees, renewal fees, and other miscellaneous fees. The board's, or the Health Licensing Office's budget does assume ratification of fees that were established in the current biennium. That is in House Bill, or Senate Bill 5523 that we're also hearing today. There are several policy packages in this budget. I believe that the agency will discuss each of those, so I won't take time to do that at this point. And we do have Sue Wilson from the Health Licensing Office, the director, and George Naughton from the Department of Administrative Services with us this afternoon.
Okay. Yes, Senator Trill. Just one question. Since there's a rather substantial increase over the estimated expenditures and 20.5% over the current service level, can you give us some idea of, maybe you did already and I didn't catch it, why is there so much of an increase?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, those are due to the policy option packages that are included in the governor's recommended budget. There's a $393,000 package for the office's information technology plan, which I would recommend be sent down to the Advancing Government Committee for consideration. That will be part of the recommendations that I'll make. It also includes $45,000 for rent increases, $27,000 for information system support from the General Government Data Center, and it also includes funding to continue the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, which is now scheduled to sunset in December of the current year.
Okay. And that board had been funded separately before?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you bet. Susan, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Wilson. I am the director for the Health Licensing Office. And the office was reorganized in 1999, as Rick Olson just explained to you. We are now a standalone agency and independent, and we used to be under the Health Division, Department of Human Services. We are a regulatory and consumer protection agency for multiple health programs and life enhancement programs that are boards currently within the state of Oregon. I've provided the committee with my written testimony, which is lengthy, and I'll try not to follow it entirely, and a summary sheet. There are 2 summary sheets. One is a summary sheet about the 2001-2003 budget, and it hits the highlights of our budget. So I recommend following along. I will follow this outline as I speak. The 1999 legislature recognized and reorganized the Health Licensing Office to fix discordant laws that had been established over the years. Variety of the licensing boards in our office that had jurisdictional authority in many agencies. They established the office as an initial step to streamline boards and how they operate in state government and to have them operate a little more efficiency under one budget and one decision unit. And they organized the office of the Health Licensing Office under a general management plan for boards and an infrastructure that provide state policy and coordination of their licensing, examination, and regulatory services. Our mission, of course, is to have a strong and healthy quality of life for the citizens of Oregon, and in doing so, our business philosophy is support of safeguards that protect the public while supporting economic growth. There are four goals that you will find threaded throughout my testimony. Those are assuring customer access, promoting health and safety, and promoting cooperation, and promoting a consumer advocacy agency. Under those goals, we have certain objectives that we're trying to meet. We want to ensure that there are no barriers in our regulatory environment that prevent equal access for licensure, and that we provide a cost-effective system of delivery for enforcement, licensing, and administrative delivery of our system. We hope to facilitate uniform standards, and we want to be able to communicate and educate our standards, educate the public to our standards and the consumers that we protect. What makes the Health Licensing Office a little different from the other agencies you've heard from, the other boards that you've heard from, is the governor appoints the director, and the director coordinates the activities of 27 employees carrying out the licensing and regulatory oversight for the boards under its purview. And the nine boards and councils and programs are assigned to the office and to the agency by law. Each of the board members is also appointed by the governor, and their authority rests within the statutes on carrying out the laws with respect to public protection. Board members have the very important role of setting practice standards for minimum competency for public protection. And the Health Licensing Office then has the function and responsibility for carrying out the public protection practices through our management and oversight. I've provided you with definitions that are quite specific on each of the boards that are in the office. The boards that are currently under our office are the athletic trainers, cosmetology, denture technologists, direct entry midwifery, respiratory care therapists, sanitarians, the Advisory Council on Electrology and Permanent Color, and the Hearing Aid Council. We do set the standards and control the Safe Practice Act for business and technicians who provide piercings in the state of Oregon as well. If you look at the org chart on my handout, you will see that we are divided into two sections. The Regulatory Enforcement Division has two units under its management, enforcement, investigation, and licensing and credentials. The enforcement and investigative unit supervises all the operations for all the boards and programs for complaint processing, mediation, they monitor reports and outcomes, they conduct on-site inspections of businesses, they work with state enforcement officials, and they annually monitor about 14,000 regulatory inspections and conduct 250 criminal investigations. Also within the Regulatory Operations Division is the licensing and credential portion of the office. And this segment of the office has a workload for reference. Licenses and credentials, 24 types of professional licenses within 19 distinct fields of practice. They provide examinations, both national and state, to the tune of about 8,000 per year. They evaluate 2,500 educational and credentialing pathways and continuing education laws. We also have over 200,000 monetary transactions that we process in the office. And like some of the boards you've heard from, we do our cashiering and validation within the office and under the compliance with the Secretary of State's Audit Division and the State Treasurer's Office. And we, this section has over-the-counter individuals that come into the office of about $77,000 per year. Now, the Administrative Services Division, which is at the left of the organizational chart, is the division that really has the nuts and bolts and the operating engine of the Health Licensing Office. They do fiscal coordination, coordinate the accounting and budget aspects of the office, do payroll, Information Systems Division, provide support for our information systems management, they manage our website. Program Operations Division provides newsletters, and I believe in your handout you have some newsletters regarding the Health Licensing Office and the boards that we serve. They also conduct administrative rulemaking, and within my testimony I've given you an idea of the work load for those boards, of how many board members there are within our office. We have 24 public board meetings per year and approximately 18 standing subcommittees per year. The Health Licensing Office, as Rick has mentioned, has several decision packages that we would like you to consider today. Policy Package 101 provides funding for position corrections and reclassifications that the Department of Administrative Services has reviewed. It also makes permanent and assigns a position to Central Oregon and makes permanent the funding for a limited duration position that we've had employed for about a year and a half in this biennium. The pattern of growth that we have experienced in our office, I think, is resonated in the Central Oregon area because the population there has grown so much. And you will find actual indicators on page 3 of my handout that shows that our staff workload and volume has increased, especially in the Enforcement and Investigative Division, by about twice the amount. Policy Package 102 is our information system and technology package. We have a centralized environment, information technology environment. We have and receive our services from the Department of Administrative Services, the General Government Data Center. The package will continue to align the Health Licensing Office with state standards that currently meet internal controls. And most importantly, this package will allow us to do e-business and e-commerce. We are in line to be one of the agencies that EAS is going to set up soon, I hope, for e-commerce and providing open business for our licensees. This enhances our customer service in that a respiratory care therapist who may be working in a healthcare clinic on the days of the week that they can come into the office could actually log on to the computer at midnight, send in their continuing ed requirements on an application form, and pay by credit card and renew their license. And so this provides service without having the individual having to come to our office to actually submit the paperwork and transaction.
Sure. Yes.
Would that also, thank you, would that also in time reduce the, if it will reduce the paper and reduce the handling, would that have an impact on staff as well?
Chairman Hartung, Representative Winters, I believe because the staff person has to be at the other end to evaluate that continuing ed and actually make the cashiering transactions that comply with the State Treasurer's Office and the State Secretary of State's Audits Division, that there wouldn't be an elimination of staff on our end. There would be an elimination and reduction in paper. There would be an elimination and reduction in that individual having to come to our office, gas, mileage, loss of work. They could mail the information. It would slow the process down for them. We think that this is a customer service aspect of our office, and I think in answer to your question, I could not guarantee that it would actually reduce staffing.
Senator Trobe.
I was wondering how it's working. I know it's been a while since we combined all of these boards together, but clearly you've got 9 separate councils or boards or whatever you want to call them Do each of them have an appointed board that goes with it? And generally speaking, do those boards meet periodically? So you've got to service those boards meeting, board meetings and talk about the business of each separate board. Is that how it works?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Crow, that is how it works. Each board has their statutory purview under operating to set the minimum standards for their regulated profession. It is the staff of the Health Licensing Office that carries out those standards, but the boards do meet. In fact, we have about 24 meetings per year.
Your administrative staff, do they divide up among the boards? I mean, say if you've got three administrative staff people, do they each serve three boards, service three boards, or do all the staff work for all the boards? How does it work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, your latter comment was correct. All the staff works for all the boards. There's one director, there's one rules coordinator, there's several licensing representatives, and yes.
Is there general satisfaction that that works okay?
Senator Hart.
People on those boards?
Yes, I believe there is.
That's great. Because I wasn't sure it would, but I'm glad it is. Working pretty well. How about the investigators? Do you have investigators that specialize in certain kinds of board activities? And since you've got nine different operations, or do all the inspectors get involved in all of the board cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, part of the criteria for hiring our investigators is that they have some law enforcement background. They are generalists. They understand how to deliver cases to the central hearings panel. They have a general knowledge of civil law and criminal law, and so they are professionals in that regard. If we do need technical expertise as it relates to, for example, an indenturist office reviewing a file to prepare a case to determine whether or not there was a complaint that was valid, mm-hmm. we do have contract individuals that have that technical expertise to that case that may just be reviewing case files.
Now, some boards are a lot bigger than other boards, have a lot more business than other boards. Do you allocate sort of the cost of the operations among them based on some formula that takes those things into account?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, we are in the process of coming up with that formula. As you know, we were the recipient of boards and didn't have the formula to begin with. We were the office that provided the umbrella, and of course, that's one of the items. In fact, that's in our business plan, that we have some strategy set up even for new and emerging boards and making sure that those boards have to meet some formula for need of regulation and the ability to pay for that regulation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Good. All right, Susan, proceed.
Policy Package 103 is a package that provides educational outreach, health education, and prevention campaign for individuals that are at risk for piercings and tattooists. We're quite proud of this this plan. We've already established and facilitated some relationships with school districts and middle schools and high schools and colleges, and set up at least the beginning of a plan to provide individuals with information about how to receive a safe piercing or tattoo if you are going to do that. We all understand if you have children and they leave home that the influence of parenting is gone when they've left home. And what we're hoping to do is make sure that the colleges and the community colleges have the kind of information that if a student does decide to make that choice, they do it in a safe manner and they're going to a licensed facility that has one-use needle.
Good luck.
So this is our goal
in
this package. Policy Package 104 takes into account our rent increases within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Our rent increased from $1.25 to $1.50, and this pays for common area, our testing site, and for all employees working in the office. Policy Package 105 adjusts the 1999-01 expenditure limitation from the Department of Human Services to EAS. We used to receive our central services for computers from the Department of Human Services, and now that service is provided by Department of Administrative Services, GGDC section. I believe that George is going to comment on the directing through midwifery segment, which is the final package. I will go very briefly over the last part of my testimony. I've actually given some of my testimony in answering Senator Tro's questions. I just want to make sure that the committee understands that the Health Licensing Office is continually identifying opportunities to better serve the public interest, and we're trying to explore our strengths and weaknesses this biennium, and to report any changes during the 2003 biennium. We are hoping that e-commerce will be part of our new decision, so we can report back to you on our successes with that process. We also hope to develop terminology that is standardized, so when people look at a licensing or a certification or a registration license, they understand what it means and what qualifiers are represented within that license. And we hope to establish what I will call a sunrise criteria, and that's what I alluded to when I answered Senator Tro. And our goal is to ensure that within the framework of the law that there is adequate funding for emerging new programs and boards before those programs are implemented. We've been in the dubious position of receiving boards that, while they are under good intentions, don't always have the funding base to continue or have a licensing program. Our performance measures are four, and we're proud of these performance measures because we believe that we've provided more service in the process. We've reduced transaction times for licensing individuals. We have same-day licensing in our office. An individual can come to our office with a completed transaction and all of their qualifications, and instead of waiting 7 to 10 days for us to mail out the license, after they've paid their fees, they have same-day licensing. If they qualify and pass the examination, we hand the e-license to them on that day. We also have tried to improve our efficiency as it relates to inspections. We believe the Central Oregon investigator that is currently stationed in that area will assist us in this. We are currently spending about $12 per inspection. We'd like to reduce that to $11. We're also working to reduce our issuance to receipt for violations, and the agency's performance goal for this particular measure is to reduce from 30 days to 20 days that process. And of course, back to our website, we want to make sure that we have more consumers getting more information off of our website than ever, and we're hoping that that performance measure will be as high as 80%. The budget-related legislation, the fee legislation, is something that Rick has already mentioned. It's 5523. This is ratification of fees adopted through rulemaking during the 1999-01 biennium, and those fees will need to be ratified by this committee. Finally, I want to present our affirmative action report. The Health Licensing Office is very proud of this segment of our office. We've been actively a part of improving our numbers for the last three biennia. We believe our office represents the diversity of the state of Oregon. We have 5 FTE of the 27 that are of color. We have 18 staff employees that are women, 69% of our staff. We have individuals with disability representing 3 members of our staff, and we recruit and make this a goal of ours when we have open positions. In conclusion, the Health Licensing Office is committed to promoting increased education and awareness for our customers and our license holders. We are committed to removing any barriers within the practice of any of the boards that are under our office, but not to sacrifice the public protection segment that our office provides. We will continue to make prudent and wise choices as they relate to shared technologies and centralized services, and hope that you will assist us in adoption of our budget today.
Thank you, Susan. That's good testimony. You've obviously been listening to testimony in the other committees, because shared technologies and centralized services is very much on our mind. We thank you for that. Any questions for Susan?
I have one question.
Certainly.
And it may be something that you have resolved, but I recall there was an issue at one time that had to do with braiding of hair, not in by licensed technicians. Was that issue resolved?
Senator Tro, Representative Winters, that's an issue that we are in discussion with the Senator Gordley's office, I believe, contacted our office. Currently, under the licensing law for cosmetology, that would be part of the cosmetology licensing practice.
And you're not planning to dilute that standard, are you?
We are, at this point, waiting for Senator Gordley's office to help us proceed in the direction that she...
Well, I spoke with my beautician here in Salem, who would not like to see the standards reduced. Her position is that, she has to go to her training, that there are some issues involved in skill. There's the investment that the person makes in order to become a license. And so I might want to include her in this discussion because it is not universal that it is okay to have some population to go ahead and to work on people's hair without being licensed. So I will offer her name to you.
Okay.
And so that she may have the conversation with the good senator, because I suspect that if you did a further poll in Northeast Portland, you would find that those who are licensed would probably share the same concern.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, I'm interested in House Bill 5523. I don't have it with me, the ratification of the fees adopted through rulemaking. Is there a list of the fees in this book, and can you direct me to where those fees would be found?
There is a list of Senator Hartung,
Senator. Can we hold that till we get to that bill? That's next on the agenda. The fee bill.
Okay.
That be okay?
I do.
Okay.
And he
so we're going to get a list.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Any other questions for Susan? Thank you, George.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. Before I get into my testimony, just a couple of oversight issues for you. You've heard in front of this committee a number of different small boards, each of them coming to you in their individual capacity. The state of Oregon, over its illustrious history, has touched lots of different methods of dealing with these small boards. This is a different model of that, if you will. This is a single agency, as Sue mentioned, that really does all the administrative functions for 9 individual boards and has a consolidated administrative function. There was considerable concern when this all started that those individual boards would lose their individual autonomy. And the approach that the state of Oregon has taken is to really leave it up to those boards as to how they want to consolidate those functions. We have not forced other agencies or other boards to move into this model, and just like we do not force boards to move semi-independent status last biennium, we really give them the option to do that. It works in this model because there really is one large board, which is the Board of Cosmetology, which really consumes about 71% of this budget. And all the rest of them are much smaller and can kind of tag on to that larger administrative structure that the Board of Cosmetology provides. So that just is the brief overview of how this thing is structured. We would not encourage forcing this structure upon anyone, but allowing the boards to kind of evolve as those individual boards would choose to do. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, with that, I'll begin on page 2 of my presentation, which I think everyone is very familiar with. Yes, Mr. Chair, that is it. And we have sliced this a little differently than Mr. Olson has. We show a 14.9% increase over the legislatively adopted budget for last biennium, and you'll also see on that page it is a 20.5% increase over the current service level. The reason I want to highlight the LAB change, which is slightly less than the current service level, is that there are some changes which I will talk about below, about what phases in and what phases back out, technical issues that I'll walk you through, but may skew this, making it look like it's a lot larger increase than it perhaps is. Page 3 just identifies that this is completely underfunded by licensing fees. Page 4 is just a highlight to show you that we maintain in this budget all of the current services of the agency, plus adding three primary policy packages that are not necessarily technical in nature. The first one is the big IT package that Mr. Olson has recommended going to the e-commerce committee. We continue the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery that was expected to sunset. I will speak about that in a few minutes. And then we reclassify 8 positions and continue a limited duration position into the next biennium. The reclassifications, if I'll just mention that, when it first came to us in the governor's recommended budget process, we reviewed those 8 positions and identified one of those which we thought should be reclassified to a different level. That reclassification has been changed as part of the governor's recommended budget. There was no dollar change in the bottom line because it's really from one classification to another, but did want you to be aware of that. Page 5 just identifies that there is only one program unit for this agency, which is the whole ball of wax. Page 6 just notes for you that 61% of this budget is personal services. There's no direct special payments out there to clients necessarily. It is primarily the office functions, the administrative functions. Page 7 is where we'll start walking through the current service level issues, and there were one primary emergency board I want to bring your attention to. That was that during the last biennium, the last legislative session, there was a new board added to this agency. It was the Board of Athletic Trainers. The legislation passed as part of the last legislative session, but the budget was not approved during that time. The budget actually came back as an emergency board item down the road, but that was one of the large issues that increased the budget during the interim. The current service level changes, I'm going to highlight 2 of them for you, which will make the current service level budget a little skewed. The first one is that there was a one-time technology project approved for the 9901 biennium of about $200,000. A lot of the projects that you'll see, or some of the projects you'll see in the technology plan for the 0103 biennium, we originally wanted to do some of those during the 9901 biennium. But during the 9901 biennium, the agency split from the health division and moved to this different administrative structure, and we had to delay some of those functions in order, those technology packages, in order to get the rest of the administrative stuff to happen. So what you'll see for a budget purpose is that we eliminate in current service level that entire $200,000 of one-time expenditures, and then you'll see a policy package down below, which Mr. Olson mentioned, where we add back a number of those things, and we will talk about that with the e-commerce committee. The second issue that skews the budget is the third bullet under current service level adjustments, which is that the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery under current law is due to sunset during the 2001-2003 biennium. From a technical standpoint, what we do is we eliminate as a phase out all of those activities that are not going to continue. And so we have eliminated $69,000 worth of expenditures under there. Let me give a little bit of history here, because this would be the largest concern that I have as an analyst watching over this budget. The Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, and I'm going to look to Sue to help me out here, has under 40 licensees. These are midwives that go into the home and help with home births. There is not a mandatory registry, or there's not mandatory licensure for that population, because births are not considered a medical procedure, and therefore someone can go into the home and help do that and be unlicensed. Now, there are a number of reasons that we do that. There are a number of communities that have, because of either religious or cultural reasons, they don't want to be licensed with the state, but they believe very strongly in having home births. Where that led to us is that the only reason primarily that people seek licensure is that in order to get third-party reimbursement, through either an insurance company or through the Oregon Health Plan, you have to be licensed with the state of Oregon. That reimbursement from the Oregon Health Plan did not materialize as it was originally anticipated to when this board was created in the early 1990s. So the number of licensees with the Board of Direct Entry and Midwifery had dropped considerably since the time this board originally started, which led to cash flow problems and that there was not enough revenue. Not necessarily to support the licensure, because that was the easy part, Where we got into trouble was where we had a couple of very large litigations that came out of some perceived or accusations of misconduct on the part of the licensee. And anytime you get into getting into a discussion with revoking that license or disciplining that licensee, you get into very touchy legal issues that have very high stakes in them. We got into a couple of lawsuits during the last biennium that made this board, in essence, bankrupt. We then floated them through, or the Health Licensing Office floated them through last biennium, and with the help of the legislature, we increased that licensing fee for direct entry midwives to the point where it stands currently. If you want a license with the state of Oregon as a direct entry midwife, you have to pay $2,000 per year, which in our opinion is unsustainable or is very, 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 very difficult. I was very surprised that during the interim, the direct entry midwives came forward and they were able to do that. They had their, I think 30 of their licensees came in registered at that level. Now, for you and for us, the concern is whether or not they will be able to continue that into the future, because there's only about half of those people, we believe, who are actually getting third-party reimbursement. So I lay that history for you just to understand the backdrop of how this board is continuing into the future. Now, we did propose legislation this time that would remove the sunset for the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, but I did want to highlight it for you because that is probably the largest issue outside of the typical policy packages dealing with this board. Turn now to page 8, which is really talking through the policy packages. And I'm going to just briefly touch these because I think Sue did an excellent job of walking through them. Package 101 is the reclassifications that we mentioned and the continuation of the investigator that Sue mentioned. The bulk of those costs are going to be the continuation of that investigator position, which for budget purposes, again, disappears at the end of the 9901 budget, and they have to add it as a new position for the 0103.
Sure. Senator Trill.
Now, it was, as you evaluated this position, reclassifying these positions, you believe that all these positions were necessary positions for this agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, yes, we do. We reclassified
them, and that would result in some salary improvements because you reclassified them.
That is correct, Senator Tro.
Did you do that based on the Hay classification system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, I am not a personnel expert, but that is the system that I believe Human Resource Services Division employs.
These mostly positions held by women?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, no, I believe over half, yes, over half.
Okay. What was the reason for the reclassification? Are they doing different things now, or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, the classification specifications more accurately fit the duties of the positions and the duties those individuals were performing after desk audits of those positions.
So it's you sort of reevaluated the work they were doing, and these classifications, the new classifications, fit what they're doing.
That is correct.
Okay.
Just a follow-up.
Yes, Representative Winters.
When did you conduct your desk audits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, the desk audits began back in the last biennium when we were still within the Health Division. So the Health Division Personnel Office under the Department of Human Services conducted many of those desk audits. Then when we did the transition into Department of Administrative Services, we basically sent the entire package over to their office and they reevaluated it. So it's had two desk audits.
Some
of them.
Question, and I just want to go back a little bit, Mr. Naughton, when the discussion, was there any discussion when the consolidation of bringing all the boards under one umbrella, was there any discussion that would lead to less employees, more employees, because, you know, when we talk about consolidation, we talk about efficiencies. Mm-hmm. Was there any efficiencies discussion held at that time? Or was there any expectation of some efficiencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, even though we officially did the the joining of those agencies last biennium. In fact, that merger had occurred quite a bit before.
Yeah.
What had happened for budget purposes is that six of those boards at that time, were within the health division for budget purposes, and two of them were within the health related licensing boards. But in practice, in actuality, they were all located under Sue Wilson's shop at the health licensing office. They were all co-located there. They were already taking advantage of those efficiencies. Mm-hmm. So what we did last biennium is just made the budget match up to what was really happening out there in the field. So we did not accrue any additional savings from what they were already doing. I think that in the short term, the way I would say it is that there has been quite a bit of growth, especially in the Board of Cosmetology, and by having the administrative structure work the way it does, we think that we're able to stave off some of adding the employees, and you don't see large increases in the number of employees this biennium. We're really only continuing the limited duration that we had last time.
So that wasn't an expected objective then by doing the consolidation?
Mr. Chair, package 102 is the technology package, as I mentioned. Package 103 is the body piercing and tattooing package. Package 104 is the rent increase with the Department of Veterans Affairs, which I believe has already gone out to the floor. And then package...
Yes, Senator Trove.
On the information system technology plan, you've evaluated that. It's a pretty decent plan as far as you're concerned. What's the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, the technology plan has gone through the Department of Administrative Services Information Resource Management Division, and they have confirmed to us that what the agency is doing is very much in line with where the state of Oregon is going as far as e-commerce goes. Okay. Now, I am not a technology expert, and so I have to rely on their judgment about that, but where, from the budget perspective, they have the resources to get there. They still have an ending balance of roughly $300,000. And the plan that they've laid out matches up with where the state of Oregon is going strategically.
Well, is it your advice that it's time to do this kind of thing, or is it time to delay doing it and wait for a while?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trell, our recommendation would be that we continue forward. This is the time to move into e-commerce for this agency.
Thank you.
Yes, let's see. George, are you done?
Mr. Chair, there's only two more packages add there. Page 10 is really where we finish out. Policy package 105 is just the routine support for the information technology that they're currently receiving. When they were part of the health division didn't actually charge them for the service they were providing. And then when they were split apart, they had to contract with the Department of Administrative Services.
Maybe they would have been back over there on the other side, huh? Just aside.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, package 106 is the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery that we talked about before, and I believe that bill has passed out of the House 57-0 already. So with that, Mr. Chair, there are no technical adjustments. The other thing I would note is that there are no proposed fee increases for the next biennium. We did have some fee increases that happened administratively this biennium, but we're not projecting any need for that into the next biennium. And Mr. Chair, that is it.
Senator Trove.
Those were done by administrative rules, and they just need to be ratified by legislation. Is that it? They're now in effect and being.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Other questions? Either Susan or George? No. Thank you very much, Rick. What do you have for us?
Mr. Chair, we can move into Senate Bill 5523, the fee bill, if you would like to do that.
What about why don't we do the 5521.
That's what we're just doing.
And, well, we haven't passed it.
We don't have a work session scheduled today.
Oh, that's right. We don't. It's public hearing.
Work session scheduled today.
Sure. That's right. Okay. Monday. That's right. Okay. So we'll now move into the public hearing on the health licensing office fee bill.
Just here, if you'd like
you bet.
To hand those down. Actually, we're scheduled for public hearing only today. We'll have a work session on this bill as well on Monday, so you would hang on to these. It does have my recommendation, but I provide this to you. The second page are the fees related to the health licensing office that were increased through administrative rule in the current biennium and the need for ratification. I believe that there's support for that. The last two pages are letters, copies of letters that have come from Sue Wilson, and with acknowledgement that there's agreement through some of the state and national professional associations. I did give you on at each of your places this afternoon some testimony from Sue Wilson on this, and she's here to testify regarding the fee bill.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Trope.
Sue, can you tell us what sort of process you went through as you prepared these fee increases, how you involved the boards and their constituencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, I'd be happy to. We have an established process of community outreach. We always hold advisory group meetings in advance. We invite any of the professions that are even related to these boards. We hold public meetings, and before we actually even draft the rules and take the information to the board, we hold one or two of those meetings in advance. Then we take the information to the board, and generally board members attend those meetings as well, but they're not an official board meeting of the jurisdictional authority. Then we take the information back to the board. Our rule writers sit with the rules subcommittees of those boards, and they actually go forward based on that. After that happens and the board has their proposed rules in place, then we go through the Secretary of State's process for advance notice, make sure that we have public notice, and we have a separate hearings officer that comes in and actually mediates at the hearing for any testimony. So the board is not involved in that process. So there's a real open process with this hearing officer that listens to any of the public comments. After we've done all that preliminary information gathering in advance, generally the hearing process goes pretty smoothly. So in both of these cases, there was not any objection to the fee increases based on that preliminary six-month process.
Question.
Yes, Representative Winters.
Do you hold your hearings during the day or in the evening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, we hold them during the day.
Are most of your beauticians, particularly in cosmetology, are they employed during the day and would have a difficult time getting to those hearings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winters, we're very conscious of the fact that cosmetologists do work during the weekdays and the weekends, but as in a general practitioner's facility, they take Mondays off. So we hold our hearings on Monday. This is something that we found out over the years, that their days off tend to be Sunday and Monday. So we hold our hearings on those days to accommodate that group.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question, please. Okay, let's say I'm a beautician. I have my, I'm licensed as a beautician, but I have my own facility, and I pay my facility license renewal, and then do I also have to pay the original independent contractor registration?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, if you are a facility owner and a practitioner, you would pay a practitioner's licensing fee, and you would pay a facility licensing fee. The facility owners pay a shop license fee. The independent contractors would pay a separate fee. They're independent businesses or subcontractors that would work within an established shop.
So basically, the independent contractor would also pay the practitioner fee. Why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the independent contractor does pay both the independent contractor fee and the practitioner fee.
Well, let's see now. They've already been paying, the practitioner has already been paying a license fee to practice within that facility. Then another practitioner would have to pay their practitioner licensing fee and the independent contractor fee to license within the facility fee that's already been paid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, if I could clarify. The independent contractor fee is a choice that the individual makes to do their own taxes and not be part of an employer-employee relationship. Many of many practitioners, in fact, most practitioners are employees within a shop, and they don't pay that independent contracting fee. If they choose to do their own taxes, to have their own business cards, have their own phone, and work as a separate subcontracting business within that facility, then they have to pay the independent contracting fee, but only then, and they make that choice. It's not a mandate. They can be an employee within that facility and only pay the practitioner's fee.
So what advantage is it to them if they want to be an independent contractor? Do they get tax counseling from your agency on that, or? I see no advantage to them having to do that, I guess. I'm just trying to understand your fee structure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I can't answer for the practitioners that decide to do that, but they believe they want to be independent. They don't want to be controlled by an employer. They don't want, they don't want that process, and they want to be in total control of their business. And in that case, the law gives them that ability to become independent contractors, much like subcontractors do for contractors in the building trade. And we're under that overarching law of what is the definition of an independent contractor. And if they determine they fit that definition, then they determine that they want to pay that fee and they want to be outside that process. And, yes, I think it is an IRS issue. And, yes, we do provide a link with our IRS office to make sure that they understand their responsibilities as licensees, as their employees, and as independents with their independents.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Yeah. Further questions? George?
Anything else
to add?
Okay. No.
I guess you didn't add anything on 5523 to begin with. Okay. All right. Is there any other questions? Are there any other questions? Any other business to become before this committee? If not, we are adjourned.
Oh, my God.
I know. I just got.